I'm Elizabeth Madrigal.
And I'm Karen Morrison.
And we're the hosts of the Women's Mosaic, where the real lives of women and girls are shared and celebrated.
In this space, we honor the feminine and amplify the voices of women speaking their truth.
The Women's Mosaic delves into the real lives of local women through story-rich interviews, learning what works and what doesn't to enhance the health and well-being of women in our community.
We strive to share unique perspectives, resource sharing, and instructions on how to be kind by any means necessary. Welcome to the Women's Mosaic.
Listening to part two of our interview with Emerina Daniels, an author, educator, and podcaster who specializes in trauma-responsive educational practices for adult learners.
Welcome to the show.
Hi, I am really, really psyched to be here. It's very exciting.
We're excited to have you. So to start off our conversation, we'd like to ask you to tell us one thing you'd like our listeners to know about you, and it can be anything.
I thought about this for a long time, and I was like, what is appropriate to share and what is not? So what I came up with is I didn't start drinking coffee until about 15 years ago in my whole life. I had not drunk coffee. And then a student brought me some ridiculous Starbucks confection. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is really good. And I got a little energy boost and I really liked it, but I was morally resistant. I was like, I am not a coffee drinker. And I resisted for a long time, but I finally broke down and I went to a roaster in Sellwood in Portland called the Blue Kangaroo. And damage was done. So now I am,
okay. Yeah.
Now I'm an official resident. I'm a coffee snob with a whole lot of uninformed coffee opinions. I think that makes me a real solid Pacific Northwesterner.
My people. My people.
Mm-hmm. Uninformed coffee snobs.
I'm a tea drinker for life.
Oh, I love tea too.
Okay.
I do.
Okay. You write that facing the impacts of trauma on adult learners is a disruption, but also a critical intervention. Can you explain why understanding this matters and how educators should initiate the first step?
It's important to understand that all learning brings change, and all change requires learning. So it's a constant cycle of learning and change and learning and change. There's nothing that you learn that doesn't change you. And this is why I think people are very afraid of change, is because learning has always been so painful and we've been so harmed around learning. And we talked about this a little bit earlier. So all of these, you know, sort of people who escape college, you know, out of high school, or they survived high school. I mean, how many high school movies and series do we have about like getting through the trials and tribulations of high school? So every person that I've met has had an experience of being punished for trying to learn or for allowing learning to change them. So when you're talking about families earlier, what is the thing that people in family systems don't like? They don't want you to change.
Truth.
They can't just allow you to change and be on your own, because when you change, it disrupts the relationship, it disrupts the relational cycle, the relational dynamic, and that is really uncomfortable for them. And if they felt more confident in who they were in the relationship, it would probably be less disruptive. But we get, you know, complacent in our long-term relationships. And this is just kind of what families do, is they set up these challenges for us. So that's a good example of how you get punished for change. And it can show up in education in various ways. But most of us have had that experience of being punished for change or for trying to change, which means trying to learn or trying to implement what we've learned, far more than we have been celebrated for trying, learning, making mistakes, and trying again. We are almost never celebrated for that. We are almost never given any kind of, appreciation for the effort. And then when you tell people you appreciate the effort, it becomes like a joke. Mm-hmm. It's like, we're giving people a participation award. And I'm like, well, maybe if we took more seriously that the amount of work it goes into, for example, for a small child to learn how to play soccer and to become a competent, highly skilled, a young adult or adult soccer player, then maybe the participation awards would be something more serious. It mm-hmm. would be more mm-hmm. acclaim for people as they learn things. But people are terrified of changing. And because all of that learning brings change, they're terrified of learning. So whenever I convene a group of people for learning, I start with a gathering exercise I created that really focuses on reminding us of those light bulb moments that everybody loves. We don't always remember them as learners, but certainly if you have ever worked with adult students or even children, or if you've ever taught in any capacity, you know what those light bulb moments right. are. Mm-hmm. And those are the moments when your brain is actually making a new connection. Like there is actually a thing happening in your brain and it lights up a new area of your brain. And it's this moment of incredible joy and it connects us to all other learners and learning, but it is the exception and not the common, which is like beautiful in a way, but also really sad. Mm-hmm. That so much of our learning is about trying to overcome being shamed and not consistently seeking these moments of new connection. And so we're here, I think, as humans to learn and experience and grow and adapt and expand. And when we subvert our ability to learn and make it so painful to learn that people will do almost anything to avoid it, that is a tragedy. And to be clear, people do not stop learning. We're always learning. But the presence of all of this unhealed trauma, whether it's educational trauma or other kinds, changes the way that the brain works. So when we're in this constant state of agitation, our threat response stays activated. That constant agitation means that the amygdala, the fear center, is often in charge. And that means that there's some amount of stress chemicals that are always present in the brain and in the body. And those things are fine if we're trying to like get away from a saber-toothed tiger, but right. Our body is not meant to be able to well tolerate the presence of those chemicals for extended periods mm-hmm. of time, days, years, whole right. lives.
Right.
So when the amygdala is running things, not only are these like stress chemicals present, the other areas of our brain, like the higher functions, critical thought, imagination, reason, our understanding of time, our memory, those are all operating at a reduced capacity. So communication across the regions of the brain is also reduced. So even if you want to use those higher functions, all the stress chemicals can mean that they're slower to respond and they're also kind of on standby mode. So we're not able to access them in the same way that we would if our bodies are like settled and regulated. And now the whole idea of like regulation has been just turned into this sort of checkbox of things. And mm-hmm. this is what people mm-hmm. need to do. And I'm like, I totally understand why it happened. And I was very worried that it would. And it did. Because it doesn't, you can't just walk in and be like, go in the corner and regulate yourself. That's just not how it happens. Like, that's just not, it's just not how it works. And I think that when we, because we never stop learning, when we're in this constant state of agitation, most of what we learn is just related to survival. Mm-hmm. And we become really good at being at brute survival, and survival is necessary, but to what end? Like, what are we trying to survive for beyond just like brutishness? So this is where I think being trauma responsive holds the most promise, in that it gives us more access to these parts of our brain that we need to imagine beyond only survival. And Miriam Kaba, Ruha Benjamin, Bettina Love all write about this need to imagine beyond the baseline of survival and what it takes to move that imagining into reality. So I think that covers the why this matters. And for the how, the trauma responsive principles are, I think, a starting point. So they're settle your body, mm-hmm. preserve dignity, strengthen connection, prioritize relationship, and encourage autonomy. And they aren't quite in order of importance, but you can't really help other people if you are in a state of distress. So tending your own body first is pretty crucial. True. And mm-hmm. if you cannot do anything else, even if you are freaking out, you can always treat people with dignity.
Absolutely.
Full stop. There is no excuse for not treating people with dignity. I don't care what the circumstances are. You can pretend.
Right.
You know, you
act,
can pretend.
Act
or,
as if.
Or to quote Ta-Nehisi Coates, is silence not an option? I mean, shut up. If you're going to be, if all you can do is be a jerk.
Right.
You know that you are in such a state of distress that the only thing you can think to do is be mean. Shut up.
That's right.
Yep.
Just
that's
shut
right.
your trap. Just say, you know what? I am not in a good space right now. I'm just going to take myself mm-hmm. over here. Mm-hmm. That's the best I can do in this moment mm-hmm. is just to like be quiet.
Right.
So take the advice, be silent and let somebody else handle it, or let the situation be what it is and don't make it worse.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because, you know, sometimes running your mouth when you're in a bad place makes it worse. And that,
are you sure?
I mean, I don't know, but that's what people tell me.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I wish sometimes I had a self-mute button. Because I would mute myself.
I mean, you do. You have two fingers. Pinch your lips closed.
Oh, I put on two masks before just to make sure.
Karen, you speak truth. And so
everybody wants to hear it, though.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But does everybody need to hear it? That's the question.
It doesn't even matter. It needs to be spoken.
Yes.
Whether other people want to hear it, don't want to hear it, it's irrelevant. Yeah. It needs to get spoken.
Yeah, true.
You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. We've been talking to Emerina Daniels about what it means to have a trauma-responsive educational practice. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and then continue our conversation when we come back.
KXRW programming like this is made possible with the support of The Columbian, proud to be Southwest Washington's leading news source. Since 1920, the Campbell family has owned and operated The Columbian and ensured its award-winning news coverage. For the most thorough daily coverage of local news, national news, and local sports, both in print and online, and for subscription information, visit Columbian.com. That's Columbian.com.
Shriners Children's has opened a new pediatric orthopedic clinic in Vancouver. The clinic provides evaluation and follow-up care for children and teens with orthopedic conditions, including sports-related injuries such as sprains and fractures. Care is available regardless of a family's ability to pay. The Vancouver Shriners Children Clinic is located at 900 Northeast 139th Street, Suite 204, and is open Monday through Friday. Information about services and scheduling is available at shrinerschildrens.org/Vancouver Clinic.
Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Today, our guest is Emerina Daniels, an author, educator, and scholar. Our conversation with them continues.
What information about their lived traumatic experiences do teachers need to have?
I don't think teachers need any specific details about a person's unique experience, but that answer needs context. So I think that teachers, and I'm talking about teachers in school. I am not talking about in therapeutic environments.
Right.
So when I talk about this, I'm talking about non-therapeutic environments. So teachers do need to understand the real and direct impacts of structural, systemic, and historical violence. They need a good set of tools and approaches and knowledge for addressing and countering that violence in their classrooms. So racism, misogyny, ableism, transphobia, homophobia, speech-related discrimination, things like this. Sometimes those tools might include asking students to share their experiences and sometimes not. But regardless, students should always have the option to say no and have that no be accepted without pressure.
So could you give a little more explanation of what you mean by that?
So I think that it's really important. I see this in higher ed a lot, especially in writing. When you get into writing classes of various kinds and the teachers are like, I just want students to delve into da 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 da. And I'm like, you're just a trauma tourist. Mm. And your intentions may be really good. I mean, we do want people to be able to reflect and examine and to go in and like get in and dig around in their experience. But demanding that students perform that and not having them be engaged in like a consensual agreement process of like, what does that mean? Because when you demand that people do that, if they don't, it's very easy for them to like rip open an old wound. Mm-hmm. And then the teacher's just like, well, but did you dig deeply enough?
Oh, God.
And the person's like cyclically bleeding out all over the place. And the teacher's like, well, you just didn't dig deeply enough in that. So I think that it's not the idea of asking someone to stretch themselves and to learn to handle discomfort, but the way that we are taught to do it and the way that teachers think about it, I think is really a misunderstanding of what it means to challenge people to push themselves. There is something about, for example, if you are someone who does not understand racism or thinks you're colorblind, for example, then asking you to examine the impacts of racism on a particular group of people or a racist incident, that would be pushing somebody into their discomfort zone. Mm-hmm. That is very different than asking somebody who has been subject to racism to recount in detail all the ways they are microaggressed every single day. Ugh. That's totally different things. And so I think that that piece of it, where teachers need to discern that and to also be really clear, what are you trying to accomplish by asking students to do this? When you are asking students to do some kind of deep dive into whatever it is, what are you trying to accomplish? You need to be very clear about what you want them to learn from that. Otherwise, you're just a trauma tourist and you're asking them to go in there and dig around in their pain for no real clear reason. So they need to understand that. And they need to know that if that doesn't feel like something that they can safely do, that they can come to you and they can say, I don't think I can safely do this. What is my option? And you need to be willing to work it out with them. Because hurting people just because you can is really...
Yep.
Notice I did try to self-censor there.
And we'll edit that out.
Yes. So I think that... I have very strong opinions here because I have just seen it happen in higher ed. I see it happen in the community all the time. People have really good intentions, but they press people to like go on stage and vomit up their trauma. And then they just leave them sitting there. There's no closure. You open up this door and you have somebody go through it and then you just can't get them back out and you can't close the door. And that's really harmful. I can't emphasize it enough. It is very harmful. And people do not always feel like they can say no for a lot of reasons. You're in authority. People are very grateful to have their stories heard, you know, but there are ways that you can help people tell their story that doesn't harm them. And it doesn't dump a bunch of trauma on people in the audience.
That's right.
How many times have people on this interview sat in the audience and listened to somebody and felt it just hit you, just like in your body? You're like, oh my God, I really want them to stop talking right now. Like, this is really hurtful to me to hear this, or it triggers something that happened to you. Like, why? Why are we doing that? What do you want people to learn? Like, what is the outcome? And and I think we don't think it through enough, you know? And also, people are really disconnected from their own bodies.
Yes.
So they're not paying attention to, like, if I come up to Elizabeth and I'm like, well, I feel like at this next panel, you should tell me about your most painful childhood memory where your mom said something mean to you.
Oh,
and you're over there.
I'd have a hard time choosing.
Right? Choosing one. But you're over there and you're like moving around and I'm just not paying any attention to you. I'm not paying any attention to my own discomfort. And so I am, but you don't feel like you can tell me no. For various reasons, whatever the reasons are. Right. So you end up on a stage.
Yeah.
You end up on a stage and for no reason.
Right.
That makes me very unhappy.
And for us too, because we're like, we remain solution based.
Yeah.
So if there's no end game, there's no outcome, what was the purpose?
Yeah,
what was the hidden agenda for her to just tell you her whole life to a room full of strangers and traumatizing the traumatized.
Right.
That's got to be a crime.
Yeah. I mean, I wish there was some kind of, well, I don't know. We should pause the crime thing. It's definitely doing harm. It's definitely doing harm. And I think that because the question about how we criminalize things, I think is an interesting question that we don't have time for today. I would love to talk more about that.
So can you give us a few examples of strategies that can help students rediscover themselves as capable, confident learners?
Yeah. I took this question really from the perspective of teachers, because I think that students, if we're talking about young students, they may or may not have the same issue, but I thought, well, what advice would I give teachers about helping students do this? Mm. So I thought, number one, the teacher needs to rediscover themselves as a capable and confident learner, and they use that as a guide. So what do you want? Would you want to do what you're asking your students to do? Would it make you feel confident and capable? And that's first thing. Second thing is assume the best. Always honor people's dignity. The third is learn with students. Don't be afraid to tell them that you're learning something new. Don't be afraid to learn from them. There is no magic formula. There is no magic method or approach or pedagogy or framework or rubric or checklist or anything like that that is going to fix our system of education. There's no one thing that anybody can do that can fix it. But I think that this piece of it is where we start. I mean, there's certainly many, many factors, but I think that, you know, being shamed during learning has a way larger impact on people than we currently realize.
Right. Mm-hmm. So for students with authority issues or triggers, what teaching behaviors or tools can be utilized to manage an implied, you know, you spoke about this power dynamic.
The obsession with the word respect. I hate that word because it's almost always code for obedience or supplication.
And or submission.
Yeah, or submission. And so when someone says someone doesn't respect them, it usually means that the person didn't obey them or show like a proper amount of deference, whether they deserve it or whatever. So they didn't grovel enough. They didn't subjugate themselves. And that is as true in education as it is in prisons. So there are times when obedience is necessary, like a great crisis or an emergency, where if you don't obey someone, it could mean the difference between life and death. But a student challenging a teacher on a point is not a life or death situation. Right. It is not a great emergency or a crisis. A student should not have to bow down and grovel because you had your feelings as an expert challenged. Are you going to make it better? Or are you going to make it worse? What is making it better even mean? Like, I would say, does it build rapport with the rest of the class? Does it strengthen your relationship with the student? Are you modeling the kind of treatment you would want to receive if you had that question? Mm-hmm. You know, are you showing respect for the student? Are you calming down? Are you checking your tone of voice? Are you lowering the volume of your own voice? What can you do that will give the student some autonomy in that moment? You know, these are the things when I think about like disciplinary issues and whatever, are they the sole thing that people should do? No, because I don't know all the different circumstances that can happen, but I think they're a good starting point.
Thanks so much for being here, Emerina, and thank you for your quest to inspire joyful learning.
Well, we're really, really happy you were able to make it. For information about Emerina Daniel's work, podcast, and educational services, please visit their website, meoutloud.com.
You've been listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. That concludes the second part of our interview with Emerina Daniels, an author, educator, scholar, and podcaster. If you'd like to hear part one of this interview, visit kxrw.fm and click on the Women's Mosaic show page where you'll find the streaming link.
And that's our show. New episodes broadcast on the second and fourth Tuesdays, but you can stream any episode online anytime.
We are so grateful to our guests for sharing their knowledge and life experiences with us in their support of the health and well-being of women and girls.
So until next time, be kind by any means necessary.
And remember to honor your power.
Más sincera, por eso te doy todo lo que soy. Como tú, como un hechizo de amor en mis venas, como reflejo, como primavera. No hay nada que me llene más que tú, no. Podrás confiar al fin en alguien que te quiera, que de su amor y de por ti la vida entera. Alguien que te enamore y que sepa cuidar siempre cada momento. Hoy aquí vengo a decirte que ando loco por ti. Nena, provócame, anda, acaríciame. Si tú me quieres, tengo toda una vida para darte mi amor.